There was a scenario when this week began that would have included a Senate vote on healthcare. Well, that obviously didn't happen, and now Senator Mitch McConnell is trying to salvage a plan that could remake 17% of our economy.
We're still working toward getting at least 50 people in a comfortable place.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. So today, we're going to go deep on what a healthcare overhaul could mean for the opioid crisis and for a very vulnerable group of Americans. One aspect of the Senate bill that's being discussed, cuts to future Medicaid spending. That's a really big deal in Ohio. It's a Republican-controlled state, but one where Medicaid was expanded by the governor, John Kasich, under the Affordable Care Act to about 700,000 people. Ohio is also in the middle of the opioid epidemic.
What you hear on the streets from police officials is that it's getting out of control. From the coroners are telling us that they don't have enough room to keep all the overdose bodies.
That's Marlene Harris-Taylor. She covers healthcare for WVIZ PBS IdeaStream in Cleveland. We spoke earlier, and I asked her what would happen in Ohio if the Senate healthcare bill were to pass.
Well, it depends on who you talk to, but according to our own governor, Governor Kasich, he says it would be catastrophic for the state of Ohio. Some 500,000 people would probably lose their coverage from the Medicaid expansion. And even Ohio Senator Rob Portman, who's a Republican, has serious reservations about this expansion. Right now, he's one of the holdouts because he's really worried about this opioid crisis. And he feels like cutting people off of Medicaid when they have been able through this expansion to access treatment will be terrible. It'll be a big setback for the state.
There is a school of thinking that I've heard people cite that say, well, enabling access to insurance and therefore pain clinics and opioids made the epidemic worse. Does that hold any water, according to your reporting?
I don't think so, because what I have been told by all the experts is what made the epidemic worse was the free access or the easy access, I should say, to pain pills. And especially in southern Ohio, there's an area of southern Ohio that's considered part of Appalachia. And the area is very depressed economically. And there were these what they call pill mills there where doctors who were unscrupulous were prescribing these pain pills. People just walked in off the street and they would give it to them for anything. And so many people in that area became addicted. The state found out about this. They cut off access to these pill mills, you know, trying to do the right thing. But then you had a big group of people who suddenly couldn't get access to these prescriptions and they turned to heroin. And that's kind of the path that you find a lot of people have followed to this terrible addiction. So it's difficult for me to understand how providing treatment for people who want to get clean is fueling a crisis.
When you look at sort of the landscape of what has changed in Ohio since the ACA went into effect, what do you see?
Well, one of the things that you do not so much see, but you hear about from the medical community especially. The medical community says that people are now accessing care who could not access care before. And that's one of the reasons that all of the major hospitals in this area and across the state, really, including Cleveland Clinic, which is well known around the country, have come out against this bill because they have seen the results. They see that even though some people who came in through the expansion are still using the emergency room at rates that they shouldn't, when those folks do go to the emergency room, they now have some insurance. So the hospitals are now getting paid. The hospitals before would have to just write that off as a loss, and then they would pass that cost on to consumer, to other consumers, people with private insurance. So the hospitals say that they now have that stream of money coming in that they didn't before to cover this group. Also, another thing to keep in mind is I spoke with a gentleman who's the executive director of a group that provides treatment for folks who are addicted. And he told me because of the expansion, he's been able to increase his staff 25% to try to help the people who are addicted. That's because they have the Medicaid insurance. So if suddenly the Medicaid expansion were to go away, he wouldn't have that revenue stream. And he said he likely wouldn't be able to keep those people on. And that's another worry that's been expressed by many medical groups across the state, is that, you know, the hospitals are the number one employers in most communities now. And if the Medicaid expansion goes away, that's going to mean a loss of many jobs.
Marlene Harris-Taylor covers healthcare for WVIZ PBS Idea Stream in Cleveland. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
We are going to stay with healthcare. Cuts to Medicaid spending wouldn't just affect states like Ohio, but also people with disabilities, their families, and their healthcare providers. There are thousands of long-term care facilities here in the United States, and many of them go unnoticed. But they play a big role in providing care. What would policy changes mean for these small hospitals? We sent our producer Eliza Mills to a pediatric skilled nursing facility in California to talk with the owners there.
If you didn't know what to look for, you might drive right by Totally Kids Sun Valley Specialty Healthcare without noticing. Totally Kids Sun Valley is a small hospital in Sun Valley, a neighborhood 17 miles north of Los Angeles. It's tucked away in a residential neighborhood full of ranch-style homes and small farms. It shares a parking lot with a church. Down the street in one direction is an elementary school. In the other direction, a Chevron station. Michelle Nydam, who owns the hospital with her husband Bob Nydam, says that Totally Kids Sun Valley and hospitals like it are almost invisible.
I do think there's a layer that goes unseen, and I think that people want it to go unseen because it's hard to look at. I don't think we all want to think of ourselves as getting old and being in a SNF.
SNF as in skilled nursing facility. That includes nursing homes, rehab centers, and small hospitals like this one.
I think that here people don't want to think of their kids as being in a pediatric subacute.
Subacute is basically one level down from the intensive care unit. Kids here need 24-hour care.
It's easier to look away, and I think people want to look away. I think even being here, you want to look away sometimes. It's very painful.
There are 45 children living at Totally Kids Sun Valley, ranging in age from a few months old to 21 years old. Patients are dealing with a wide range of medical issues. There are premature babies, kids who've been in near drownings or car accidents, victims of gun violence. The hospital has 220 skilled staff to provide care, and it's around the clock. Here's what it sounds like in a typical room of the hospital. Those are the machines that keep the kids here alive. Patients at Totally Kids Sun Valley use ventilators to breathe. They're also hooked up to pulse monitors, feeding tubes, and in some cases, dialysis machines. Running a small business in healthcare can be a challenge. Here's how the Nydams describe it.
In a small business, it's obviously trying to run the business, make money so you can pay your staff well and provide good care. But it's also caring for the kids, emotionally caring for the kids. And sometimes it's an internal conflict to provide the quality of care and have a budget. We get paid through insurance, private insurance, and after a time the insurance falls away and we are on Medi-Cal. We work with the very fragile kids. And so it's a balancing act at best. I always tell people who come in here, this is not a place that you want to visit, but if you need it, we are very good and we can help you.
Well, we spend money on first and foremost is our staff. I mean, that's our most important resource. And so a majority of the funds are going right back into the people caring for the kids. In terms of the facility, we have to be up and running all the time. Since kids are on ventilators and respirators, this can never shut down. A lot of these facilities are on a straight medical model. They're really meeting the kids' medical needs. And we're really on a whole person model. We want to make sure these kids have an entire circle of life. So we want them to have great leisure activities. We want them to have good rehab. You know, we want them to have a normal life as possible.
The patient budget that comes from Medi-Cal is about 95%, because in the state of California, we take private pay insurance, but after, it depends on your insurance, after 120 days or so, all private pay stops and it moves to Medi-Cal.
I've been on and off surfing the net anxiously, really. And I was just looking at these statistics this morning that Medicare contributes to 64% of patients in skilled nursing facilities across the country. And they really want to cut back on that now. And over the next 10 years, it would go down significantly, to where the burden would go even more in the states. And in a state like California, we're fortunate, but we use a lot of our own operating budget here in the state of California to fund Medi-Cal already. It's got to come from somewhere, and I don't know where that is.
What would happen to a place like Totally Kids without Medi-Cal is we wouldn't exist. And so what happens is now you've got the kids that we take care of going back into the NICU or the ICU. And so what you've got then is a cost that's five times more than what it is here. You've got the NIC units, ICU units full. I don't know what they do with kids that really need high level of care. In addition, we're a community here. We've got families that come in. The families know each other. They build on relationships. And the families in our situation need a community to help just live through the everyday life.
What happens also, to build on what Michelle's saying, what happens to those 220 staff on another level is their relationships with those children. I mean, we have really loyal, dedicated staff, and I'd love to say it's us, but it's really the kids that they're dedicated and loyal to. And if they took away Medi-Cal, these facilities won't be around.
That was Bob Nidham, along with his wife, Michelle Nidham, sharing their thoughts on what changes to healthcare policy could mean for their small facility just outside Los Angeles. And if you have stories about your healthcare and what it's costing you, get in touch. You can reach us via email, we're weekend@marketplace.org, or leave us a voicemail, 1-800-648-5114, and we'll call you back. The 4th of July brings with it a busy travel weekend and the reinstatement of part of President Trump's travel ban. Lots of people are going to be moving around by planes, trains, and automobiles. But let's stop on that train part, specifically subway trains, and even more specifically, New York's subway. On Tuesday, a subway train in Manhattan derailed and 34 people were hurt. And on the less scary but really annoying front, it's gotten incredibly hard to ride the trains here.
It's not reliable. There has been delays where I've opted to walk over taking the subway if it's a nice day.
It's the weekends that suck. There's always like delays, they're repairing. You can't really enjoy the summer.
It's inconsistent. There are, you know, more than a handful of times where I've left for work 2 hours and a half to 3 hours before and still was late. You feel like you're commuting more than you're working. It's horrible. It's horrible.
A brief scan of my emails to my producer reveals a lot of, ugh, gonna be late, subway again, notes. On Thursday, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo declared a state of emergency for the transit system, which is the biggest in the U.S. and has the most stations in the world. But here's the question. Whether it's New York or any other place, how do you fix it, and how much would it cost? For more on this, I'm joined by David Bragdon, the executive director of the Transit Center. It's a foundation based in New York dedicated to urban mobility and transit reform around the country. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
How did we get to a point where the governor is declaring a state of emergency about the trains?
Well, it's not an emergency in the sense that it's a natural disaster or something that happened overnight. It's maybe for him it's a political emergency because people are noticing. But what's happened is cumulative, and it's been a long decline of the system here that has happened over many years. Even here in the most transit-oriented city in the country, transit is underfunded, which is the case across the country. But it's very noticeable here when things start to go.
What is causing this?
The basic root of it is lack of proper maintenance and taking care of what we have, and also then expanding capacity as ridership has grown.
I mean, does that all just boil down to money?
Actually, I think, to be honest, it's also how money gets spent. There's no question that more money is needed for transit, but I think it's also fair to say that money needs to be spent more effectively. We've starved transit in most places. It doesn't have a steady stream of funding and so has not been able to establish itself the way it does in other parts of the world.
I mean, someone listening to this interview in, you know, Illinois or Michigan, where my father's from, might say, well, I don't care if Lizzie has trouble getting to work on a Monday or a Tuesday. Why does this matter in a national context?
Well, metropolitan regions are the driver of our economy now. If New York goes offline and people can't get to work in New York, what is New York, 10-12% of the national GDP? It's a very important part of the economy, and that tends to be the case for the metropolitan areas in just about any state. And if they're not functioning and transportation is a big part of how they function, that's a big problem for the economy. So transit really is important to everybody in this country. Whether they use it or not, there is something that they do that depends on it.
There are other places. I mean, I think of London, which have old and giant subway systems. And I know that there are folks in London who would complain about it, but not in the way where every day in New York, you know, derailment, delays. How do other places fix this? And have they done that successfully?
They have. And it's not a technical issue. London, Paris, Tokyo, they're all the largest city. They all have national governments that help to fund transit. And transit is seen as central part of life for the population. We're in a country where we actually have a federal government that is hostile to urban areas. The federal government, the way it's constituted in terms of the Senate and the representational system, urban areas are at a big disadvantage.
Or rural areas get, you know, just as much political representation, they would say.
Well, per capita. Yeah.
Per capita.
Yeah, right. There's more people going through Penn Station today than live in the state of Wyoming. Mm. But the people who are going through Penn Station, they don't have two senators. The 600,000 people in Wyoming do have two senators.
What do you think it would cost to make the New York subways run?
So the overall capital plan for New York City Transit is $29 billion in this current five-year period. Most of that just is toward maintenance, keeping us where we are, kind of keep the wheels on. In terms of really being able to get to the type of system that we deserve and that we ought to have in terms of the frequency and the reliability, it would be much more than that.
This might seem like a silly question, but I've always wondered it. Here in New York, subways run all night long. If I want to come in and host the Marketplace Morning Report, I can take the train from Brooklyn, my house, at 4 in the morning. If we shut them down for a few hours, would it make it easier to bring things up to a more functional level?
Well, certainly you wouldn't shut them all down,
right,
at one time. And New York is blessed, actually, in having a lot of redundancy. But it definitely would be an advantage to do the heavy maintenance that required to be able to take sections out for weeks or even months at a time. And that's what the Chicago Transit Authority did. It's a real challenge for the construction pros to say, well, you're going to only be able to maintain this thing between 11 at night and 5 in the morning. By the time you mobilize, you've actually only done a few hours of work, and it takes far too long to do a project.
Before I let you go, how'd you get here today?
I got here on the Lexington Avenue line, which by itself, that's one line of the New York City subway that carries the same amount of people on that one line as Washington Metro and the Chicago Transit Authority in combination with each other carry.
Whew. David Bragdon, Executive Director of Transit Center, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Starting this weekend, anyone making minimum wage in Maryland, Oregon, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. will see their pay go up. The minimum wage scale is complicated. At the federal level, it's $7.25 an hour. Then some states have their own minimums, and on top of that, some cities have theirs. And we're going to get into this in a moment. But first, let's hear from two low-wage workers in different parts of the country and different ends of the minimum wage scale, starting in a state with no minimum wage law.
My name is Tanya Harrell. I'm 21 years old, and I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana. I currently work at the McDonald's. I make $8 an hour. Me and my boyfriend are raising a three-year-old. He makes $4 on July 5th. I'm mostly supporting our child. I will work myself more than I am supposed to be worked. And I stress a little bit more when I can't, you know, help myself a little bit more, and I'm always helping others. I have a grandmother that I have to take care of, and when she can't get her medicine, I help her. And then I can't even afford to take care of my two little sisters that's in foster care. And, like, that's, like, the main reason of why I work so hard. With the $8 an hour, $8 an hour is still not enough. Even though I went from $7.25, $7.50 all the way up to $8, it's still not enough. It's just like my paycheck still be like $400 something, and that's still not enough for rent because like now a one bedroom is like $600. Working fast food come with a lot of stress and a lot of wrong intentions to some people. And it's not enough how we work so, like, people like me work so hard just to make ends meet. I'm not going to say I like it. At the moment, it's not the best that I can do. But at the moment, it's just that I have to not settle for it, but I have to deal with certain things. And then I also have to do better than what I'm doing. The first thing I'm going to do is going back to school. When I finish that, it's like I could defeat any test that comes my way.
The story in Los Angeles is very different from New Orleans. The local minimum wage is $10.50 an hour, which is going up to $12 this weekend, which means a raise for our next guest.
My name is Ajadet Solis. I am 21 years old, and I go to Fullerton Community College. I currently live in Whittier, California. I am a hostess at IHOP of the International House of Pancakes. I currently make $10.50 an hour. I have a 5-year-old brother who's starting school in August, and I have a 9-month-old sister. My mother is currently not working, so I help her with any necessities that either my mom needs or either that my brother and my sister need. So it's like baby formula, baby food, clothes. This would be the only semester that I skip out on going to school because I don't have enough money. My money I spend on paying my car insurance, gas, my phone bill, basic grocery stuff like milk, cereal. I manage to make ends meet. I honestly don't know how. What it's like to work on a minimum wage is constantly receiving harassment from customers who are belittling you, who don't think that you can comprehend something simple. A lot of the times, management doesn't take time to actually make you feel safe. It's hard. It gets hard, and it's super frustrating because I have all these bills to pay. I have, you know, my two siblings to take care of. My main concern is them, regardless if they aren't my children exactly. I love my job. I love talking to people and to customers, and it's also hard at the same time. But even just like the little, you know, $1.50 raise, it does make a difference.
Just two stories of life on minimum wage. But for more on how it works and the history behind it, we have Gary Burtless, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
We have all these arguments about numbers, but I want to go even broader. From a philosophical standpoint, what is the minimum wage for when we think about it kind of collectively? I mean, is it for an entry-level worker or is it for someone who is working a job and supporting a couple of kids? Who did we design this for?
My suspicion is that when the minimum wage was introduced at the national level, which was in the late 1930s, what the Roosevelt administration had in mind was a wage high enough to support a family, possibly with one or two kids. But as the labor force has expanded over the last several decades, we now have families with multiple wage earners. And some of those wage earners are under 20 or 25 years old and are not the main support of the family. About 10% of the people who are less than 20 and are in the workforce are paid the minimum wage. And for people past 25, it's a lot less than that. Maybe one out of every 50 workers past age 25 is earning the minimum wage. So the notion that the minimum wage ought to be high enough to support a family with a couple of youngsters is probably not describing what the situation is for the most part for minimum wage workers today.
Well, if a city council or a state government or the federal government is thinking about changes to the minimum wage, who should they be designing it for?
Well, I think it probably is a mistake to set the minimum wage at a level that is high enough so that a single wage earner by himself or herself can support a family consisting of four people. Now, of course, many people earning the minimum wage are supporting dependents, and I think that there's an obligation, a social obligation, to ensure that that person after taxes is earning enough so that they can comfortably support a family. But that doesn't mean that the minimum wage by itself is the only policy tool that voters should look at to accomplish that goal. We should also think about earning supplements, for example, and under the earned income credit, or supplements to top up the amount of food that families can consume if they have low wage earnings.
We heard different portraits of what it is like to make minimum wage, but I guess I want to back up for a second because really there is no such thing as minimum wage in the way we throw it around in conversation, right?
Well, a lot of states have a minimum wage that's higher than the federal minimum wage, and even within the same state, the minimum wage may differ from one jurisdiction to the next. But every state does have a minimum wage, if only the one that is established by the federal government.
Why does it vary so much?
Well, a lot of jurisdictions are more liberal than the United States Congress has been in recent years, and they feel that as wage levels in general have risen and the cost of living has increased, the lowest paid workers in their states or in their jurisdictions deserve pay raises. And also when voters are given the choice of lifting the local minimum wage, they frequently do so. Popular sentiment favors minimum wage increases more than almost any other policy that the government could pursue that lifts the incomes of low-income working families.
Yes, wage increases have been popular with voters in a lot of places, but you get pushback from, say, small business owners, people who are afraid that, you know, this is going to hurt their ability to hire people, hurt their ability to pay workers. What do you say to that?
Well, I agree with that. I think it's valid. The question is, at what point do we think lifting the minimum wage starts to do more damage? And at what stage does the harm begin to offset the benefits to low-wage workers of earning higher hourly pay?
I want to ask you about Seattle. Seattle has moved towards raising its minimum wage to $15 an hour. And there's a study out this week from the National Bureau of Economic Research. And, you know, this study said that the average low-wage worker in Seattle lost $125 a month because of the hike in the minimum wage. When you see that, what does it tell you? Do you say, ooh, maybe they went too far because they, you know, are actually hurting workers? Or is it we don't know yet?
I haven't read the study yet. I've only read summaries of the study, so I don't think I'm in a very good position to offer a critique of the statistical validity of the finding. Some low-wage workers have been hurt by being given fewer hours of work and have seen their weekly earnings fall instead of improve. That is possible. And in fact, I think that most rational and observant labor economists would say that that's always a possibility if you raise the minimum wage too high.
You know, since 2009, the federal minimum wage has nominally remained the same. If you adjust it for inflation, it's fallen a little bit. Should there be a national minimum wage hike in this economy?
Yes, I favor boosting the minimum wage. I think that raising it in steps to $10.50 an hour, which is more or less what President Obama proposed, is a judicious increase, and I'm very skeptical that the employment losses or hours of work losses would be very large in the current environment.
Gary Bertlis, economist at the Brookings Institution, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Love your feedback on the show, and we asked our followers on Facebook to tell us how they feel about minimum wage. Dini Good in Overland Park, Kansas said, "Inflation of the price of everything is all it ever causes." Kevin Green said, "As a business owner, minimum wage does two things. Number one, at least in California, payroll tax basically doubles the cost to employers. And number two, as the cost of labor rises, the incentive to automate tasks increases." And Tom Hendricks in Dallas asked us not to forget about theater workers, who he says are paid the lowest wages and benefits allowed by law.
We encourage your comments, and you can email us anytime, weekend@marketplace.org. And while you're writing to us, why not sign up for the newsletter? Just do that by also going to marketplace.org. As you may know, we here at Marketplace love to do the numbers and put a little context behind them. And that is why we bring you this week's news by the numbers with producers Sarah Menendez and Tony Wagner. Hit it, Sarah.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
66,000.
That's the number of posts Facebook deletes per week for hate speech.
Investigation by ProPublica found some interesting ways Facebook's content reviewers, those are real people, are being trained to identify hate speech.
For example, the phrase white men is okay because both the words white and men are protected categories.
But female driver or black children don't alert any of the sensors.
So are the sensors people or a computer?
It's kind of complicated. It's people, but the computer alerts them to try to find the speech in the first place.
17.1 million.
That's the average amount of money male entrepreneurs received from investors at TechCrunch Disrupt between 2010 and 2016.
Women seeking startup cash during the same time frame raised an average of 3.3 million.
Why? According to researchers, investors asked women how they'd prevent losses, but with the guys, they only asked about all the potential gains.
As a result, female-founded firms attracted only 2% of the country's venture capital.
So much for closing that gender gap.
Tell me about it. 2 hours and 42 minutes.
That's the average amount of time Americans over the age of 15 spend watching television, according to the latest figures from the American Time Use Survey.
Honestly, that seems kind of low.
I know. How are you going to get through SVU at that rate?
You can't do it.
Pathetic.
We could not do a pre-4th of July show without talking about food, and specifically hot dogs. If you have been watching our social media this week, you may have noticed we revisited one of the internet's favorite questions. Is a hot dog a sandwich? And I'm on the record as a big no. It's just not, okay? But we have someone here who can settle the score once and for all and give us some facts and tips about hot dog consumption, and I'm going to let him introduce himself.
My name is Eric Mittenthal. I am the president of the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council, also known as the Hot Dog Top Dog. The biggest myth that people don't know about them is how they're made. It's very simple. Hot dogs are made from the pieces of meat cut away from your steaks and roasts and then are ground up very finely. They're mixed with spices, stuffed into a casing, and cooked, and that's it. We estimate that Americans will eat 150 million hot dogs on July 4th alone. Over the course of the year, we estimate people eat about 20 billion hot dogs in the U.S. A third of those are eaten over the summer period from Memorial Day weekend through Labor Day weekend. The summertime really is the prime time for hot dog consumption, and that makes sense. We love to go out by the grill and put some hot dogs on and enjoy them with our families. The most popular topping is mustard, far and away. I think everybody has their own tastes, and certainly regionally, we see a lot of different preferences depending on where you live. The one rule that we have about toppings is that if you are an adult over the age of 18, you should not be putting ketchup on a hot dog. It is just not appropriate. Really, Dirty Harry said it best in his movie Sudden Impact. Nobody puts ketchup on hot dogs. And if you're in the city of Chicago, they probably tell you that at any age, you cannot put ketchup on a hot dog. I'd say a chili dog with mustard and onions, that's the perfect hot dog for me. Beans and Franks is the best way to go if you're not going to put your hot dog in a bun. It's just a classic flavor combination that goes back a long way. This is America, and people are welcome to do and believe what they want as related to hot dogs. And it's part of American culture that it's freedom of speech and expression, and we embrace that wholly. But we say a hot dog is not a sandwich. A hot dog is its own wonderful being. It's so much more than just a sandwich. And so we say, no, a hot dog does not belong in the sandwich category.
So that settles that, unless you do think a hot dog is a sandwich, which whatever. But let's be honest, a hot dog really cannot exist well without condiments. And last year, Americans bought $764 million worth of ketchup and $436 million in mustard. That's according to Euromonitor. And there is a clear market leader, at least in the ketchup department, Heinz. Heinz tomato ketchup is sold around the world in more than 140 countries. So we called up Nicole Kulwicki. She's the head of brand building at Heinz to figure out how you get to be the ketchup.
Well, the Heinz brand, it's been around since 1869, so it is a very well-established brand within the ketchup category. So we're actually nearing our 150th anniversary. And even from the beginning, H.J. Heinz was very keen to promote the value of people being able to see the quality of the product within clear bottles. And so we've really continued to promote those ideas and values as a brand and also in all of the products that we have launched since then and into today.
I mean, I got to figure that, you know, your classic Heinz ketchup is still your best seller. Do sales go up in the summer?
We definitely do see a spike over the summer grilling season. So for your 4th of July barbecues, Memorial Day barbecues, those are the time frames that we do see a spike as consumers are enjoying all of those great foods. One of the things that we do have that is a popular seller for us is actually our picnic pack, which is a three-pack of Heinz ketchup, mustard, and relish. And so that is actually a very popular item for us in the summertime, particularly because it just in one, you know, a one-stop shop for your summer grilling trio.
I guess I have to know, do you put ketchup on your hot dogs?
I absolutely do put ketchup on my hot dogs, yes. I know here in Chicago that is somewhat of a tension point, but I do put ketchup and mustard actually on my hot dogs.
So you're a dual ketchup mustard girl?
I am, absolutely, through and through.
Okay. I have an extremely controversial question for you.
Sure. Go ahead.
Do you consider a hot dog a sandwich?
You know, I do not, actually. I think it's really in its own category. I think hot dogs stand alone apart from sandwiches and apart from hamburgers. I think they really are in a category of their own.
Good. That was the right answer, by the way. The internet might disagree with us, but the internet is wrong.
Oh, that's good to know. Don't want to cause any undue controversy, but that is my opinion.
Nicole Kulwicki, sauce boss. Sorry, that's your title now to me.
I love it. I'm taking over. I'm telling everyone here that I have now been deemed the sauce boss.
You're the sauce boss. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
And now, my terrible dad joke of a pivot from hot dogs to actual dogs. The 4th of July could also be called National Comforting the Family Dog Day when you hold them or let them crawl under the bed because of fireworks. But hey, wonders of capitalism, we are now surrounded by anti-anxiety products that you can buy for your dog, like a $40 Thunder shirt or some $10 calming treats. To explore this market, which according to PetSmart has gone up 45% in the past 3 years, I enlisted a very special guest who lives with me. This is Mara, and she's my new dog. And, you know, because we're talking about things that soothe dogs on the 4th of July, it seemed helpful to have a real-life volunteer. Hi.
Hi, I'm Marty Larson. Nice
I'm Lizzie O'Leary.
You.
Nice
yeah,
to meet
nice
you.
Nice to meet you.
And this is Mara.
Beautiful dog.
Thank you.
So you're at a PetSmart store in Brooklyn. We have an entire section in our store, all of our stores, calming solutions for dogs. We also have them for cats. Dogs can be nervous on 4th of July. There's a lot of booming, a lot of noise and vibration. They feel it differently than we do, and they get anxious. And so these are calming solutions that can help on the 4th of July. We have everything from the Thunder shirt, which kind of swaddles the dog and puts pressure, especially in the chest area, to calm them down. And then we have products with pheromones in them. Huh. And the pheromones mimic the pheromones that they experienced when they were in their litter with their mom. And so those have really nice calming solutions, calming properties. Everything from a diffuser to a spray to a collar.
Sorry, someone is trying to eat the cord.
Uh-oh. No chewing on the cord.
No chewing on the cord. It's a bad mommy held the cord too low.
So collars, diffusers, sprays, and then we have toys that you can infuse with drops. And then so these have like distraction elements to help them just get their mind off of the booming and the vibration. And then we have chews and oral supplements that have chamomile and tryptophan in them, which have calming properties. So you could give that to your dog on 4th of July.
When you guys, you know, think about your calming stuff, I mean,
Is the 4th of July something that drives people into the store for this?
It does. People come in all the time gearing up for 4th of July, and the more popular products are kind of combinations of everything.
Hmm.
Pet parents see a calming effect, certainly with the pheromones, and they also see it with the supplements.
Can you explain how a thunder shirt works for I mean, we're on the radio, so
right.
What is this thing? I know what it is, but what is it?
So it looks a bit like a dog harness. You tighten it, you put it on pretty tight on your dog, and it just creates kind of like a hug or a swaddling effect, like a swaddling effect with a baby.
Hmm. Can we try one?
Should we try a small?
So good in your radio debut. Good go, Mar.
There.
Oh, and that goes across her chest. Yeah. Should I Velcro this on?
Yeah. What do you think, Mara? What do you think?
How does that feel? How does that feel, Buggy?
Oh, big yawn. Maybe she's relaxed. Big yawn. The Velcro works pretty good, huh?
Yeah.
Like, I think pet parents can just kind of regulate and then do their own hugs on top of it if needed.
So I got to ask you, you use the phrase pet parents.
We do, yeah.
Why?
Well, because pets are members of the family.
It feels like a new thing. It feels like when I was growing up, we used the term owner. Why do you think pet parent has become a term that is used?
There's two things that are kind of driving the industry. The humanization of pets is a trend that we see quite a bit, and the premiumization of pets. Pet owners are now treating their pets to things that they enjoy. So, say I enjoy hiking. Maybe my dog's going to have a backpack. Family member, we celebrate birthdays with them. We celebrate their gotcha days. What was her gotcha
day? June 11th.
Yeah. And then the premiumization is really about offering them high-end things that we love, like limited ingredient food or organic food or a spa treatment at our grooming salon. It's these kinds of things that pet parents are doing with their pets.
And do you see that reflected in what people come in and buy?
We do. They come in asking for innovative solutions, and we listen, and then we deliver those products to them.
Yeah, how many products do you think we're looking at here? It's a lot.
Maybe 20?
Yeah.
20 plus?
Mara, you're a little quiet. This is the radio.
Hi.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
That was Marty Larson, the public relations director for PetSmart. And if you want to see a picture of Mara or Mara Jade Skywalker to give her full and proper name, you can go to our website, marketplace.org. And one more thing for the 4th of July, why not sit down with a great book? On the Marketplace quiz, we've heard from a lot of literary folks. And we asked some questions about work and money, the lessons they've learned throughout their careers. This week, we dig into the archives for some wise words.
My name is Roxane Gay. I'm the author of An Untamed State and Bad Feminist, and forthcoming Difficult Women and Hunger.
In a next life, what would your career be?
In my next life, my career, kept woman. My next career would be an emergency room physician. I've always wanted to be a doctor, and I just love the idea of working with a lot of different kinds of patients and meeting a lot of different kinds of people. You know you'll never get bored working in an ER.
What is the hardest part about your job that nobody knows?
The hardest part about my job is having to go on television and having to do a lot of public events. I'm a writer because I don't like people. I'm a writer because I'm shy. I want to be behind the scenes. And I didn't realize that when a book takes off, you have to go in front of cameras. So that's the hardest part.
Has it been getting any easier?
Mm-mm. No. It has not necessarily been getting easier, but I am getting more used to it.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
Oh, the iPad Pro. I never use it, and it really is very, very big. And that's what she said. And it's just so large. And when I'm holding it, it barely fits in my hands. True story. It's not practical. I mean, sometimes you just need something to be just a normal size.
When did you realize that writing could be an actual career?
Oh, I don't know, but I'll let you know when I do find that out. I think in the past 5 years. I mean, I've always known it can be an actual career, but it was really, I think, about 5 years ago when I was 36 that I realized that you can cobble together a reasonably good life as a writer.
Do you remember the first time you got paid to write?
The first time I got paid to write was for an erotica anthology when I was in my 20s. And they paid $50. Now I just take those same stories and publish them in literary magazines.
What advice do you wish someone had given you before you started writing?
I wish I had been given advice on how to handle criticism and the kinds of, you know, when to respond, when not to respond, how to take the best of the criticism and, you know, how to discard those things that aren't really going to make you into a better writer. You know, just advice on how to handle criticism.
How do you think you handled criticism when you first started?
Not very well. I handle it the same way now. You are trash and you don't deserve to exist. Now, when I first started out, you know, I took it really personally, of course, because writing is oftentimes personal. And the deeper I've gone into my career, I still take it personally, but I have learned and I continue to learn how to really hear what's valuable in that criticism so that I can become a better writer and thinker. And I've also learned which pieces of criticism are not so much about me, but about the person who wrote the criticism, and knowing when to just make that distinction and ignore what that person has to say.
Do you think that you're pretty good at giving criticism?
I'm very good at it. No, I teach, so, and I teach creative writing, and so you have to learn how to give criticism, and I do think I do it well, because with a background in teaching, I try to remember anyway, that you want to make someone better. You don't want to tear them down, and so I try to be supportive while also being very frank, because I don't think it's bad to hold someone's hand, but I do think it's bad when you make them think that they are perfect or that they can't improve, or when you sugarcoat criticism. And so I try to be frank, but also kind.
Roxane Gay's new memoir, Hunger, is out now. And that's our show for the week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills, Paulina Velasco, and Sean McHenry. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez and Drew Jostad are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president and general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Have a great holiday, and thanks for listening. This is APM.